At this hour, firefighters are trying to manage the levels at the new Nuuanu Reservoir. The Board of Water Supply says water is at the 1.5-foot level below the spillway. Crews have been monitoring the situation overnight. Emergency management personnel are coordinating with Chief Engineer Ernie Lau should an evacuation notice needs to be issued. Some 10,000 residents in the valley could be affected by a breach. We go now to the city's Emergency Operations Center, where spokeswoman Kathleen Pahanui is on the line. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what can you tell us at this point?
At this point, BWS and Honolulu Fire Department have pumpers going to lower the level of the dam. Overnight, it went up about 4 feet, which is what brought it near our spillway.
And so what's the situation as far as any kind of notice if one needs to be issued to alert the residents down below?
Okay. We are below the action level for an alert right now, but we did want to just send something out to the media so people could at least be aware of what's going on. Obviously, there's a lot of activity there, so we don't want people to be unduly alarmed.
Okay. And then what are the reports from the field? How many units do we have out there with the fire department?
We have a couple of fire trucks out there that are helping us pump, plus we have three of our own pumps in there as well, plus a couple of siphons.
Now, if I recall, when we had the Coloco breach on the neighbor islands, the state actually went out and inspected all of the dams and reservoirs. And at one point, the Board of Water Supply even, I think, lowered the level. And you folks had stopped the annual fishing.
You got the wrong dam. We're talking about Nuuanu Dam number one. Number four is fine. There are no issues with number four. That's where the fishing is.
Gotcha. Okay, so this is a separate
Correct.
One. Which is the larger one?
Four.
Four is the larger one. Okay. And so is there any other backup plan at this point?
Right now we're pumping. That is our primary plan. And from what we can tell looking at it on our monitors, pictures from the site, we have cameras there. It appears as the level is going down. And from the radar, from the weather radar, it looks like the rain should be easing off this afternoon.
Okay, so we just got to keep our fingers crossed, but everybody should just stay alert and monitor the situation.
Correct.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll be checking in with you later. Thanks so much, Kathleen.
Thanks, Catherine. Appreciate it. Aloha.
Aloha. And social media posts are showing the wide-ranging damage from Tropical Storm Olivia, including a house and several cars being swept up in the raging water on Maui. The flooding buckled roads, unleashed mud and rock slides, and winds knocked out trees. Maui News reporter Chris Sugidono joins us live with a snapshot of how the Valley Isle and the rest of the county is faring there this morning. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
So you were down in that area where that home was kind of swept away.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I saw the video, and it was pretty pretty dramatic.
Yeah, it's pretty alarming.
Yeah.
So what's happening now?
I think now, I haven't gone out there today, but I know that last night it was pretty much a swamp. I mean, it was really muddy, and actually one of the families let me borrow boots from them so I could trudge along, and a lot of people were just kind of assessing the damage and looking at their homes. There literally were cars that just kind of piled up in different spots. And if I had more time, I would have took a lot more photos, but I was literally on deadline. And it was kind of difficult getting out there because I had to get a ride from one of the families to get out there because even the road itself was, it was puddling in a lot of areas. And you kind of almost need four-wheel drive to get out there because it's completely off the grid. But the spot, the family that I spoke to, which I don't know how many other homes might have been swept away, but I believe the Lozano family that I spoke to was hit probably one of the hardest. And they had like three separate buildings, like a building for their kitchen and the dining room or living room. And then they had two-bedroom buildings that the parents slept in, and then the kids slept in. They had five kids that they share.
Wow, and I know that initially they were concerned that there might be some people missing, but I believe everybody's been accounted for, correct?
Yeah. And it sounded like there was some people, I think some of the people that might have been unaccounted for were trapped on the other side of the river because there's kind of part of the river, I think, cuts in between the homes. So there's like homes on the lower, below the river, next to the highway, and then homes above the river, further up the valley. So.
And what else can you tell us about that area? Did the family say that they'd had problems before?
Yeah, they said, I guess, last spring there was a really big flood that came through. But I guess apparently, you know, that it was their house was because all those houses are built like on stilts for the most part, because they know that I think they get a lot of, you know, the natural waterway. So I guess there was kind of a scare back in the spring. So I think they made some, you know, preparations for future, you know, flooding and stuff. But I don't think anyone expected it to be that bad.
Right. And I know that they had some problems, some road closures down in the Hana area. What are you hearing from the other counties, Molokai and Lanai?
Yeah, it sounds like the East Maui, Hana, and Molokai were probably hit the hardest, aside from West Maui. I know I saw a video of on Molokai, and the school was, there was a lot of flooding at the school, and then I saw one of the roads was completely, you know, covered in water and impassable. I know that most of the island, I think, lost power, and then I think there's even some that are still without power today. But yeah, I think the road out to Hana was blocked for much of the day. I think there was a telephone pole that had come down, or power lines that came down and trapped about 20 cars or something.
And is it still raining there? I mean, because it's still raining here on Oahu.
No, it looks like it's been, well, see, I don't know. Maui is so weird because you can have rain literally. I mean, I imagine the same in Oahu. You can have rain on one part of the island or one section of an island, mm-hmm. and not rain over here. But by our newsroom in Wailuku, there's not, I don't see any rain.
Okay, well, hopefully you dry out. Thanks so much.
No, thank you.
All right, that was Maui News reporter Chris Sugidono giving us an overview of how the community there is coping with the aftermath of Olivia. You know, yesterday we checked in with store owner Neil Hasegawa as Tropical Storm Olivia continued to bring wet weather to the state. He's a fourth-generation operator of the iconic Hasegawa General Store, located on the eastern end of Maui in the remote community of Hana. Neil, like his father Harry, returned to his hometown after graduating from college to run the family business. Opened in 1910 by his great-grandfather Soichi and great-granduncle Saburo, the humble shop has endured many ups and downs over the past century, including a disastrous fire in 1990. The store has been since rebuilt and continues to serve both residents and visitors alike. Overflowing shelves are stocked with a vast array of merchandise ranging from apples to Ziploc bags. One patron in particular was struck by the eclectic selections and wrote a song that turned the tiny town of Hana into a household word. The Hasegawa General Store was written over 50 years ago. And for today's backyard quiz, can you name the songwriter? Here's a hint. He's known as the father of mood music. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people that you got it right.
Upon the island of Maui, far from Waikiki, there's a place called Hana that is heavenly. And when you go there, you've got to see
the Hasegawa General Store.
They've got kukui nuts and assorted cold cuts, surfer's pants and papaya pants, a shiny core calabash to catch your eye, and some
holy hub if your throat gets dry.
So if you ever in Hana with some time to spare, then you've got to holo down to you know where. You just name it, they've got it there.
At the Hasegawa General Store.
Aloha, this is Sully Erna from Godsmack, and you're tuned to The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Well, the Honolulu City Council unanimously voted to advance two bills yesterday that could have a major impact on the city's homelessness policy. One would make it illegal to obstruct public sidewalks. The other would ban camping in any public space. Homeless camps in parks and on sidewalks are a common sight in many communities around Hawaii, especially in urban Honolulu. But there may be a legal complication to this latest policy proposal. The Conversation's Ryan Finnerty tells us how what's going on in Hawaii may be affected by a court ruling in Idaho.
Honolulu City Council Bill 52 would make it illegal to camp in public spaces like parks and sidewalks. It's part of Mayor Kurt Caldwell's program of Compassionate Disruption, combining outreach and assistance programs with enforcement sweeps of homeless camps. Mark Alexander is the executive director of the Mayor's Office of Housing.
Bill 52 is a humanitarian bill, and it's framed around humanitarian concerns. First and foremost, this administration agrees with many of our advocates who have said that affordable housing is the solution. In fact, Mayor Caldwell has made it very clear that the only solution to homelessness is housing with an effective support system. And this is exactly what this administration, with the support of the council, has been implementing. We know that this has been working. The data is very clear on this. For example, we've had the first reduction in our homeless count in over 9 years. I would point out, too, that we are on schedule this year to house 4,200 people into permanent housing from our various homeless programs. And the reason why this is being done is because of our unified commitment that permanent housing is the way to go. Now, what we try to do with our shelters, which continue to have vacancies every month, is we try to create flow, move people out of the shelters and other homeless programs into permanent housing, which then allows us to move other people into the shelters. Bill 52, as I've said before, really puts the onus on the administration. We are required to identify empty shelter space, and we are required to provide transportation for clients from the streets into shelters. We know this works because we've had an interagency effort underway since April, which has effectively moved 118 plus people off the streets into shelters, as well as a number into detox and other kinds of programs. Part of what we're trying to do is maintain a humanitarian approach and also maintain community standards, that it's not okay for people to reside any place unfit for human habitation like the street.
But a court decision from Boise, Idaho last week may influence the camping ban. Six current or formerly homeless residents of Idaho's capital sued the city after being arrested for violating Boise's ban on camping. They had been turned away from public shelters due to lack of capacity. One member of the group sought shelter at a religious institution but was turned away after failing to participate in certain religious practices. The plaintiffs argued that, because no shelter options were available, their citations were a violation of the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. A judge on the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Hawaii, agreed. But Honolulu Mayor Kurt Caldwell says the ruling won't impact Honolulu's proposed law.
This was a camping ordinance where three individuals brought a complaint. One was arrested for sleeping in a restroom. Another was arrested for sleeping in a park, and I can't remember where the third one was arrested. And based on the facts of that situation, the Ninth Circuit Court made a decision because of the city of Boise only had three shelters in the entire city. We're talking here, if you're talking about Sitlai, it's a very defined area. And when we enforce there, there is shelter space for people to go into. We have more than three shelters in the city and county of Honolulu. So I think to take this case and apply it broadly to what we're doing here is not the proper way to do an analysis. And I think the decisions made by the Ninth Circuit based on facts out of Boise are very different than what we're talking about here. On Sitlai, I think it would stand up to a constitutional challenge. It has so far, because I think we've been careful in how we've written the law and how we enforce the law. And I think it'll continue to work successfully in the limited areas that it is under this decision. I don't have the comprehensive solution where everyone will be housed. I don't know if we'll ever get there because people are addicted to drugs and alcohol or have a mental illness are difficult population to deal with. We're trying. But these are people who had families and mothers and fathers and loved ones who couldn't help them. And they moved out onto the street. If their own families can't help them, it's harder for government to do so. But we're going to try. At the end of the day, it is about affordable housing.
Bill 52 would not allow police officers to arrest or cite anyone for a violation of the camping ban if there's no room at a shelter or if transportation to the shelter is not available. But not everyone agrees with the mayor's assessment. Mateo Caballero is the legal director for the ACLU of Hawaii.
This bill is nearly identical to the law that was challenged in Martin v. City of Boise, which held that ordinances criminalizing lodging or sleeping in public places were inconsistent with the Eighth Amendment when no sleeping space is practically available in any shelter. Just as in the city of Boise, there is not enough shelter space to house the over 2,100 people without shelter on Oahu on any given night. Also, just as the Ninth Circuit recognized in that case, there are a number of valid reasons for individuals not being able to be in temporary or emergency shelter, even when such shelter is apparently available, including state limits, fees, curfews, religious proselytizing, and pet policies. Additionally, as the city's own statistics show, many of the people that go into shelter cannot find affordable permanent housing at the end of their stay, so they inevitably end up back in the streets. The premise behind this bill is wrong. People are not homeless because they don't want to accept shelter or help. Many accept such help, but stay homeless because we simply do not have sufficient affordable housing. Until we fix that, we need to accommodate our less fortunate neighbors and their communities. Bill 52 doesn't do that. Bill 52 further separates us between those who can afford a roof over our heads and those who cannot. Just like with a natural disaster, divided, we cannot overcome our housing crisis.
Bill 52 will still need to pass one more vote from the council before the mayor can sign it into law. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And you can find links to the schedule for Bills 51 and 52 and information on how to submit testimony on the post for this story at hawaiipublicradio.org.
One of those millennials that likes to set it and forget it. I have 1,001 things to do, so if I can create a way that HPR is supported through my donations without me having to continually check on it or remember to pledge, I think it puts a different value on what I'm doing with my money. Hi, I'm Nicole Reed, and I am a very proud sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
It's now time for a reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Nathan Eagle is on the line. Hi, Nathan.
Hey, how are you?
Hey, so you have a long list of campaign spending violators. Tell us about that.
Oh, you're not kidding. On Wednesday, there were about 50 or even more who were fined, totaling about $21,000 in fines. That's on top of dozens of others at the Campaign Spending Commission's meeting last month. Now, most of these are for these electioneering statements, the always fun government jargon, for basically a report on how much money they plan to spend on ads coming up. So the confusion for a lot of them was they're supposed to file these within 24 hours of the contract being signed, but a lot of them are turning in late, some assuming it should be 24 hours within the first ad running, for instance. So a lot of back and forth there and a lot of fines as a result.
So some confusion there, but I remember when I saw the agenda for that meeting, I was like, holy cow, what's going on here?
Yeah, I had never seen so many. There are just dozens. And across the board, all the way from the governor on down to council races, anyone and everyone, seasoned and first-time candidates, Debbie Hartman of UPA, the University of Hawaii's Professional Assembly, she was the only one to speak up about it. She said it's a miserable law, and that's evidenced by how many are not complying. But the commission actually gave candidates a break in the 2016 election, saying, okay, this is a new thing. We're not going to fine any of you. 2018, though, be ready. We're going to. And sure enough, they did.
Wow. So who were the biggest offenders?
Senator Lorraine Inouye racked up the most. She was about a little over $3,000 for hers. And it was, again, turning them in late, not turning them in, turning them in wrong, and then having to go back and correct those. And then it was kind of on down the board.
So is there any way to appeal these fines, or they're just stuck with it and they have to pay?
So what the vast majority of them did, if not all, especially for the electioneering statement violations, is they worked out this conciliation agreement, they call it, with the Campaign Spending Commission. That let the fines be drastically reduced by just saying, hey, you know what, we did it wrong. Thanks for lowering my fine a lot. I'll just pay it and move on.
And so what did the newbies have to say about this law, the folks that maybe just, you know, ran for the first time and then found out that, you know, they're included and have got to pay all these huge fines?
There wasn't a lot of newbies speaking up at the meeting, but what I've heard, like, outside of that was that there's just a lot of confusion. It's, oh, my goodness, what am I doing? There's all these different reports I'm supposed to do. It's hard to keep up. You know, but separate from these fines and these electioneering statements, the commission also took up a lot of dockets that were just the normal reports that they've required for years and years. And they were clearly fed up. And I haven't seen this kind of change in tone for a while. One commissioner, Gregory Shota, said, we need to fire a shot across the bow. Let's send a stronger message to these candidates who are just, you know, turning their heads and just saying, no, we're not going to do this. And we're going to just turn our reports in late or wrong. And they face these Manini fines. He's thinking, we need to up these. So his colleagues weren't quite ready for that. So, but they did agree to take it up at their next meeting. They're going to review the guidelines for how much they should be fining candidates for these different violations.
Well, I can see how you wouldn't want to have to deal with scoff laws, particularly if some of these are lawmakers and then lawbreakers.
Exactly. And the commission staff seems to really bend over backwards to work with candidates, saying, you know, they give all these follow-up emails and calls. And as best I can tell, and from what they say and other candidates have said, they are trying to help them meet the requirements of the law, because at the end of the day, it's probably less work for them. But it's also just best for the public so that we can see, you know, where these campaigns are getting their funding from and all those kind of important electioneering or election transparency stuff.
So if they have to pay these fines, when are they due?
I want to say it was within 20 days, but have to check.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much, Nathan. I appreciate the story. It's really interesting.
Thank you.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's reality check. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Television was banned in Afghanistan until the U.S. drove the Taliban out of power. Now Afghans have satellite TV, foreign movies, and a Bollywood standard of beauty. Next time on The World, a plastic surgeon helps women of one ethnic group to alter the shape of their eyes and noses to change their faces. Why cosmetic surgery is catching on in Afghanistan, that's on The World.
This afternoon at 1.
Imagine yourself as a disease detective trying to stitch together clues about how illnesses like cancer and diabetes affect different ethnic groups. Well, that's our next story. We sat down with a French epidemiologist from the University of Hawaii's Medical School to talk about a research study that looks at groups here in Hawaii and in California, and it's been doing that for 2.5 decades. Among the many links it's made over the years, it's found that Native Hawaiians and African Americans are at higher risk for lung cancer due to smoking, and obesity raises your risk for cancer in certain ethnic groups. Loic Le Marchand tells us that study began in 1978 and will celebrate a milestone this weekend.
So we have five ethnic groups mainly. We have Japanese Americans, Native Hawaiians and whites from Hawaii. And in California, we have African Americans and Latinos. And so we have collected information. So at study entry, we sent like a 26-page questionnaire, so quite long questionnaire. And we certainly appreciate all the effort that the participants have put into the study. And it was not just one baseline questionnaire, but they have filled out questionnaires every 5 years to update their information. And the kind of information we collected was mainly about diet. Something like 24 pages of the questionnaire were about diet, their dietary habits, about alcohol, smoking, physical activity, their occupational history, medical history. So any risk factors about lifestyle and medical condition that might increase risk of cancer as well as other chronic diseases.
And so you've been able to track these people over the decades here.
Yeah, we have been able to follow them. And actually, the number of people who have dropped out that we could not find has been quite small, surprisingly. And it's because there's not much out-migration from Hawaii, or if it happens, it's often in California, so we were able to find them there. The way we keep in touch with them is that we send them newsletters every year, so we get change of addresses. We have linked a call to cancer registries as well, so we can identify who has developed cancer and who has not over the 25 years.
And you're going to be getting some of those participants together in one place.
Yes, so because it is the 25th anniversary, we are celebrating with a big event, and certainly for our standard, it's a big event. We'll have 500 participants coming on Saturday, September the 15th, between 9 and noon. The event is really to thank them. It's what we want to do. We never had a chance really to meet them. I mean, certainly the investigators, some of the staff members talk to them on the phone or even sometimes meet them. But we wanted to give opportunities to the participants to come and talk to us. We'll have like an exhibit with some posters. We'll have many of the researchers working on the data are there, as well as the staff, and they will be able to ask us questions. So we're going to reverse the roles there. They will be able to ask us questions about what we are interested, what findings we have had, and I think it's going to be great.
Who are some of the oldest participants? I mean,
when they started 25 years ago, they were between age 45 and 75. So now they are quite old. We have about 200 centenarians in Hawaii and as many in California. So I think the median age, the average age, is about 77 right now.
Wow.
So yes, we have grown up with them.
Yes, grown up with them. I like that. Mm-hmm. And so will some be coming from California?
So we have a few investigators coming, not the participants, because we're not saying they would come. But we are looking at a way to do something similar. Our partner for this project is the University of Southern California, and we are trying to convince them to organize something too. Yeah.
So what's been the most gratifying thing for you, knowing that you've been able to track these people over this length of time and really get some detailed information about lifestyle and habits?
Well, personally, really is to see first, I mean, it's like seeing the community come together to do this study, because we have such a variety of different ethnic groups and age groups, and obviously both men and women, from neighbor islands, from Oahu, and they have kept with the study for 25 years, which is remarkable. We still have a participation rate of about 70% for the questionnaire. So 70% of the participants still answer our questionnaires and keep with the study. It's amazing compared to other populations, certainly. On the scientific level, I mean, I think we have made some good contributions in terms of diet and cancer. I think our findings really have been used in many countries to determine what is a healthy diet and how to prevent cancer, heart disease, diabetes. We have made contributions in the area of smoking, for example. We've shown that even for a given amount of smoking, let's say smoking one pack a day for 20 years, if you are native Hawaiian, your risk of lung cancer is much greater than if you are white, for example. And so we have been doing some studies specifically to try to understand that, and we see that, for example, the metabolism of nicotine, how fast we degrade nicotine in our system affects the way we smoke. And people who metabolize nicotine faster have a tendency to draw more on each cigarette, so they take on more carcinogens, and their risk is greater. So if you just ask them, how many cigarettes have you smoked, it's not enough to determine risk. You need really to test how fast they metabolize nicotine. So our next step now, for example, is to see if we can use that to help identify smokers at high risk for lung cancer. And then now that there's a screening test for lung cancer, with CT scan, send them for screening. So, I mean, we have really done a number of projects where we started from trying to understand differences in risk of cancer across the ethnic groups in our study to understanding the biology behind it, and now translating that into a prevention message, be it what you would expect in terms of modifying your diet or increasing your exercise. But we're also able now to make recommendations for screening, identifying or quantifying risk of people for certain cancers.
So really, then you've been able to collect all these clues to kind of send researchers on these expeditions looking for answers.
Exactly. It's kind of a detective work. And that's, when I talk to children, when they ask me what I do, I'm a health detective.
There you
go. I try to understand why disease occurs in some people more than others.
And what about, let's say, for other things that affect, let's say, the Pacific Island groups, you know, like diabetes? Have you folks been able to make some headway there?
Yeah, so many of those chronic conditions, heart disease, diabetes, and certain cancer, like breast, colorectal cancer, have the same risk factors. So what we find for one disease often applies to the others. So the dietary guidelines made to the public, fortunately, have an impact on all of those diseases. But clearly, the main issue with diabetes is obesity, and that's clearly a very significant issue in our population. We were able to contribute some data on that, which are actually quite remarkable in the sense that when you compare people of different ethnic groups with the same weight, when you have them have a scan to really measure fat tissue, you find that they are distributed differently. For example, Japanese Americans, Latinos, and Hawaiians have more of their fat intra-abdominally. And whereas African Americans have more of their fat under the skin. And that has significance in terms of risk associated for metabolic disease. So if it's more intra-abdominally, your risk is greater for diabetes. So starting again from a difference across ethnic group, we try to understand the biology and then we're trying to apply that for prevention.
I can see, though, when you have folks in this study that have kept with it, I guess the one really positive thing is that they're really doing, they're helping with the research that will maybe help their children and their grandchildren lead healthier lives.
True. I mean, it's an issue that we have with many of our studies is that people contribute their time, that give us some blood, some urine, and we don't have much to give them in return. Often they have cancers already or they are sick, and it's true that our work is really for their descendants, for the community in general, and also for not just Hawaii but other groups too. But because we focus on the ethnic groups of Hawaii, I mean, our findings are very pertinent to our population, and we think it's very important because it is likely that this specific research will not be done otherwise. You know, it's very difficult to get funded from the federal government, and we have been very fortunate to have been able to do that for 25 years, and to do that studying the local population, I think it's something we are very proud of, actually.
And how is the prospect for continued funding?
Well, we just renewed our grant last year for another 5 years, so we are doing well. But, you know, each time we have to renew our grants, And it comes back very often, every 4 or 5 years. But I think because we are contributing something which is quite unique, with this study using the same methodology across 5 ethnic groups, which are important in terms of minorities in the U.S., I think we have a good chance of getting funded. But on the other hand, the cohort is getting older, the numbers are decreasing. So at one time, I guess that might change, but I think I could, maybe not another 25 years, but I think another 10 or 15 years, certainly.
Yeah. Well, and folks might be wondering, you know, how is it that a researcher from France comes all the way over here and dedicates a lot of his life to finding out about these clues to our health?
Well, by accident. many events in life happen. Actually, I was working as a physician in the South Pacific before I came here, and I came here, I was going to come to the university, which I did. I was supposed to do a master's in epidemiology, and I did that for a year, and I was supposed to leave and try to find a job with the WHO or any international organization. But I actually went to the cancer center. That was 35 years ago.
Wow.
To try to see if I could do a summer training, field training there. And I met with my mentor, Dr. Larry Colonel, which actually will be at the event 25 years ago, and actually is the person who started the multi-ethnic cohort study.
Oh, great.
So we'll be honoring him also on Saturday. And he explained to me what he was doing, and I was very, very intrigued. I was just 2 years out of medical school. I was told that cancer was one disease, and I had no idea that there were such differences in risk across ethnic groups. And I found that so interesting that I stayed on. I did a PhD, that then got my first grant, and then got a position on the cancer center. And from grant to grant, I've been here.
And you haven't left.
I haven't left.
Well, this will be a really incredible event on Saturday, and hopefully the weather cooperates.
Yes, that's our worry at this point. But we are remaining positive, and I'm sure we have spent 6 months organizing this event. It's going to be great.
That was epidemiologist Loïc Lemarchand talking about Saturday's event that's expected to draw some 500 people. It's to mark the longest health disparity study undertaken by the University of Hawaii's Cancer Center.
Aloha, I'm Abe Legrimas, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the show, we told you about one of the oldest and one of the few surviving family-owned businesses on Maui, the iconic Hasegawa General Store, opened by brothers Soichi and Saburo Hasegawa, has been serving the remote community of Hana since 1910. Now, the shop is currently operated by Neil Hasegawa, the fourth-generation owner, who, like his father Harry, came back to Hana after finishing college on the mainland to help run the family business. This unassuming landmark sells a wide range of goods, including local food, household goods, souvenirs, and convenience items. For today's quiz, we asked you who wrote the Hasegawa General Store song back in the early 60s. As the story goes, composer, conductor, and Capitol Records owner Paul Weston was shopping for gifts for his kids when inspiration struck him to immortalize Hasegawa's in song. Pua Alameda popularized the song on the Hawaii Calls radio show, and other artists who have recorded the ditty include Arthur Godfrey, Hilo Hattie, and Jim Nabors. And congratulations to January, who called in from Waimea on the Big Island. She got it right, and she shares with us, it was raining buckets last night up there in Waimea, I believe it. And that is today's Backyard Quiz. If you have an idea for one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. dodging storms has been the story for so many people this week. We're happy to report that the Polynesian voyaging canoe, the Hiki Analia, has made its way safely to the West Coast, and it's now docked at Half Moon Bay. We talked to Captain Lehua Kamalu about how the crew fared during the voyage.
The weather in Hawaii itself was starting to get those hurricanes coming through right as we were leaving, and there were a couple of delays due to weather. We had Hector coming in, and we had Lane, and as we left Honolulu and sailed north, we didn't really have major issues with hurricanes, but the high pressure and low pressures in the North Pacific were not exactly where they usually are during the summer months, where you can consistently plan for sort of a route that heads north and around the high so that you get pretty good following winds on your way into San Francisco. So we ended up spending quite a bit of time in pretty calm wind as we went across what the high pressure center would have been, which was really apparently far to the north than it normally would have been.
So kind of dead in the water for some good patches.
It was a little slow going. I know some people who were following our track were wondering, you know, as we headed north, we probably had a pretty consistent speed around, you know, 6-7 knots. And once we sort of made our turn more directly towards the east, right around between 41 and 43 north, we had really great wind, and we were surfing down these swells that were going 13, 15 knots, which is pretty fast for us. it was a pretty wild ride during that time. And then just calm, sort of very slowly moving along at 2 knots for, I think, 5 days we were like that, and just washing our clothes and enjoying some of the warm sun in what was otherwise a pretty chilly location.
Well, now, I know you folks were going to be looking for the garbage patch. Did you find it?
Correct. So it was really interesting when we first were planning this voyage and looking at this garbage patch. I was not incredibly familiar when we started planning for the voyage about the garbage patch. You know, I'd already heard about it, but where it was located, what it looked like, what it was made up of. And so I was trying to read up to find out, you know, what's in there, what are people doing about it, how do we know about it, what's being studied. And we got to meet a couple of great scientists that are trying to understand it, where it is, how it's moving, how it's infecting the oceans. So we sailed, as we were sailing north, we tried to get as far east as we could. Before leaving, we had a wonderful team that learned about a mapping that is done at the University of Hawaii of where sort of the garbage patch might be, because it's sort of a, I don't know, not like a cloud, but it's dispersed over a very large area. But there's certainly places where you're more likely to find higher concentrations of trash or plastics, some that are floating, some that are partially submerged. And so using current and wind and weather data, they actually model there the most likely places to find it. And so we kind of sailed as high into it as we could. Of course, being a sailing vessel, we are directed by the wind. And certainly on our entire trip towards the north, we consistently saw trash. I would say we were averaging every 10, 15 minutes that would come right alongside the canoe. And we would take photos of whatever pieces that we could. We would try and identify what we saw floating by, crates, some bottles, floats, and things like that. And we didn't see anything too large on our trip or too condensed beyond that, here and there a floating massive line. And so I don't think we were in the highest concentration area. I think we kind of sailed right across sort of the western edge of it and saw a lot of that. But, of course, thinking out, you know, that we're just a little tiny vessel that can only really see up to so far around us. And on that path, seeing that amount of trash was a little alarming. Well, not just a little alarming. It was pretty concerning as we went north. But once we got so far north, we didn't hardly see anything up at sort of the 41, 42, 43 north latitude, except a pod of dolphins, actually, which was there almost every day.
Oh, neat. Neat. Anything else that struck you about this voyage going across? I don't know, maybe the unexpected or...
Yeah, I mean, the weather was certainly not what we expected it to be. The garbage, I would say, I was surprised by how much we saw in an area that we weren't necessarily supposed to see the most of it. And if I sort of multiply that out in my head mentally to the area that they believe it covers, there's quite a bit of it. The dolphins were really amazing. As we got closer to the California coast, you definitely felt the impact of having colder winds and currents and ocean running through it. It was a pretty beautiful sail in the sense that we had really great weather all the way from the beginning when we left Honolulu until we came in right off the coast of California. I think the time that we spent waiting around for the right weather window, although it was quite a long time in Honolulu and had multiple delays, it really paid off in the quality of the trip and our ability to do it very safely. And not until we hit the California coast and the more intense winds and the interaction of the land and the water here that we got some pretty heavy winds. The last night it was up to about 30 to 35 knots with 15 to 18 foot waves. So that was a little rough day, but luckily it was a short-lived time, and we were able to come into Half Moon Bay the very next morning.
So how's the crew? Good spirits?
The crew is doing amazing. This is such an enjoyable, wonderful crew to have. Each one of them is so skilled, and what they're the best at is just being a really great team and a really great family on board. So those days where we were just moving slowly across the water were just so enjoyable. We actually almost had to nickname it the Laughing Canoe at some point because just always making sure that there's good vibes going around and we keep the right energy on board. And I think that's, you know, part of the reason why we have we're able to have a successful voyage is staying positive and focusing on our task. So, yes, everyone's in really, really good spirits. Everyone's really excited to be here in San Francisco. We've had a bit of a chance to meet some of the folks here who have been so receptive. The boating, the sailing community, the Hawaii community that lives up here, they kind of had a number of people come out and paddle to greet us in really cold water. I'm going to say I didn't realize how cold water was here compared to Hawaii. And firsthand, it is not that fun to take a shower in. definitely, you know, offering up their homes and meals and whatever we need as soon as we came in, which is really, really sweet. It's just another extended island.
Well, I know how cold it can get. I think I had my first ocean dive in Santa Cruz, and I had a wetsuit on, and I couldn't handle it.
Yeah, we try to be as brief as possible in our showers. We plan it all out. We time it. We've got all of our clothes laid out right before we take the dunk. But it was really enjoyable. Actually, the saltiness of the water was something that was also surprising.
Yes.
As we got north in the middle of the ocean, I didn't even notice that was salt in the water. And it was almost something that made me realize we were a lot closer to land once I could start to taste it. you can taste the salinity kind of increase or decrease each day.
Yeah, and the kelp is amazing. It's just, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so different.
Yep.
From what we're used to.
You know, land is near when you see kelp floating by.
Yeah,
or that's a little seal, actually, which was quite a ways offshore, said hi to us. The fish, we did catch a number of fish as well. Of course, you know, we try to manage our food and water on board, and I was surprised that we were able to catch so much to kind of keep up with our meals. Sometimes we go entire voyages without one fish. And
you ate well.
Yes, we ate well, and we have an excellent cook who can make many, many different recipes.
Oh, but sashimi's just fine, too.
Sashimi's just fine, yes. The canoe is planning to return to Hawaii at the end of the year, planning to depart San Diego in November and get back home in December. There'll be a different crew aboard then as well. We'll be changing our crew members, as we usually do, throughout the voyage from here to San Diego, and then again for that last leg home from San Diego to Honolulu.
Okay, but obviously then this trip, good memories for you.
Excellent memories, excellent crew, amazing support, great weather, and hopefully we can share all of that with as many of the community here. Really excited for this weekend and being able to meet some friends and family and all sorts of new friends and family that we're making.
Yeah, all right. Well, you have a good time. Have a good celebration.
Thanks so much.
And hopefully we get past this other hurricane or this tropical storm or whatever she is right now.
Yes, definitely. As soon as we came in, they said, okay, guys, so we just have to tell you there's one more. And I said, Oh boy, is this the year we're gonna have a whole bunch of them? So yes, we're hoping for good things. Everyone's calling home and checking in on family and whatnot to be sure they're okay, seeing if, you know, there's anything we can do from here.
Right.
And certainly, yes, our thoughts and our hearts are with everyone back home that we've been missing for the last few weeks. So we're having some nice conversations and catching up on what's been happening back home for 3 weeks.
That was PBS Captain Lehua Kimalu talking about the leg of the trip from Hawaii to California. She and the crew of the Hiki Anilia are in Half Moon Bay, where the vessel is docked. The canoe will make its way up to San Francisco for a welcoming ceremony this Sunday at Aquatic Park there in the city.
Hi, my name is Jonathan Korth, president of Honolulu Chamber Music Series, and we're underwriters of HPR. HPR has been an excellent partner for us through the years, talking about our series, having various artists come in and talk about their concerts. But now, as an underwriter, yes, we have our target audience here, but we also believe in the mission of HPR, and that was one of the reasons we chose to be an underwriter for them.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here. Learn more at hawaiipublicradio.org.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, an unscheduled scientific stop for a group of researchers studying seamounts. And we continue to look at efforts to clean up after Tropical Storm Olivia. Got a storm experience you want to share? Call our talkback line. Leave us a comment. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find our podcasts online on The Conversation page. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for The Conversation.